If you're innovating, creating, or making a difference,
this show is for you. Welcome to Over Coffee. I'm Dot Cannon. Here on Over Coffee, we talk with artists and innovators about the process of changing the world in terms of what they do.
If you can get their body temperature down below that 104-degree threshold within 30 minutes' time, they're going to survive, and there's most likely not going to be any long-term issues. And that's what we have seen in our research and the cases that we've treated ourselves.
In July of 2001, Minnesota Vikings pro offensive tackle Corey Stringer collapsed on the field during practice. The temperature had been in the 90s. Corey died the following day of exertional heat stroke at the age of 27. Following the tragedy, Corey's widow, Kelsey, worked to develop an institute to prevent similar deaths from heat stroke. The result is the Corey Stringer Institute, or KSI, which opened in 2010 at the University of Connecticut. KSI's goals include preventing sudden death from heat stroke among athletes at all levels, as well as active individuals in the military and the labor force. William Adams is the director of sports safety policies at the Corey Stringer Institute. The following podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Before we talk about what the Corey Stringer Institute is doing, I'd love to know a little bit more about you. What do you remember best about your growing up years that inspired you to become an athletic trainer?
When I first got into undergrad, originally I wanted to go to med school and become a physician. And then after about three semesters, I realized that I really wasn't as interested as I thought I was, but I was still interested in some field of medicine. And athletic training was always kind of an option, so I started to pursue that route and got into the athletic training program, graduated from that, and decided to get my master's so I could get some clinical experience. And then I got into doing some research and loved that, so wanted to continue that, stand on to my PhD, and I was still able to do some clinical work as an athletic trainer.
How did the dangers of exertional heat stroke first come to your attention as an athletic trainer?
So as I was looking at graduate school, University of Connecticut was one of the options that I was really interested in. The big reason was Dr. Casa, who is my advisor, was one of the faculty at UConn, and his research interests around heat stroke and preventing sudden death in sport and, you know, hydration issues in sport and physical activity. So reading up more on him and what he's published in the past and reading up some other research in that area, became very intrigued with heat stroke and heat illness. And then coming to UConn from my master's, I had the opportunity to volunteer as medical staff at various road races and had the opportunity to actually treat some heat stroke patients at these races. And then from there, it just became kind of a passion of mine from a clinical standpoint as well as from a research side of things as well.
On your website for the Corey Stringer Institute is a fact I did not know. This actually shocked me. Heat stroke is 100% survivable if somebody falls over with a heat stroke?
Yes. And yeah, a lot of people don't realize that. But with exertional heat stroke, just to give some background, so heat stroke is separated into two different areas. You have classic heat stroke, which is usually seen in the elderly or infants, basically because they don't have the thermoregulatory capacity to handle the heat. So you would normally see this in and during like heat waves, and with, you know, either the elderly people not having access to air conditioning and whatnot, so the oppressive heat overwhelms their body's ability to handle it. Exertional heat stroke is, as the word says, exertional, so there has to be some type of physical activity involved with that. And basically, with physical activity, your body temperature rises like normal, but with exertional heat stroke, what happens is your body is unable to dissipate that heat that's being produced by your working muscles. So, obviously, that's a medical emergency because if your body stays above 105 degrees Fahrenheit for a lengthy period of time, your proteins in your body start to denature, the tissues and muscles in your body start to break down, and there could be long-term catastrophic outcomes, or worst case, there could be death. So the goal is to make sure that, you know, the body is treated quickly and appropriately. So if someone collapses during activity and heat stroke suspected, and you take an accurate body temperature immediately, see if it's above, you know, usually we use 104, 104.5 degrees Fahrenheit, along with altered mental status. Those are two key diagnostic criteria for heat stroke. if you notice that and you begin cooling their body down right away with cold water immersion, which is basically you put their body into a ice tub with water and ice and you circulate the water, you know, quickly. And if you can get their body temperature down below that 104 degree threshold within 30 minutes time, they're going to survive and there's most likely not going to be any long-term issues. And that's what we have seen in our research and the cases that we've treated ourselves.
Tell me, please, about some of the current initiatives on which the Corey Stringer Institute is working.
Yes, we're involved in a ton of initiatives right now. Just to name a few, previously we looked at the extent of medical coverage at the high school level. So for about 3 years of time, we actually called every single high school, both public and private, in the United States, and that's about 24,000 high schools. So we called each high school up to four times to try to get a response from them. And the goal was to see the extent of medical coverage during athletics events. So if they had an athletic trainer, yes or no. If they did, you know, the extent of their coverage. So, you know, if they were full-time, part-time, if they were contracted through a clinic, and the sports that they covered. And if they didn't, we wanted to know if there was any other medical coverage, such as like an EMT or whatnot. And if there was no athletic trainer, kind of reasons why. So that took about 3 years in total to make sure we called all 24,000 high schools. And we got some pretty good data as far as what we previously knew in terms of what the medical coverage at high school level was. So we were able to find that 72% of schools had access to an athletic trainer to some extent, whether it be full-time or, you know, for DM basis on games only. But we found that about 80 to 85% of student athletes at the high school level had access to an athletic trainer. Now, this makes sense because obviously the larger high schools with more students were more likely to have an athletic trainer versus a small rural high school. So that was exciting news for us to see that. So we were able to publish that last year in the Journal of Athletic Training from the public high school data set that we had. And the private high school data set was accepted for publication and should be out later this year in the Journal of Athletic Training. So from that, what we've been doing is we're trying to get a better representation of the high schools and the medical coverage there. So we've been working along with the National Athletic Trainers Association and with the National Football League to try to help expand our data set. So obviously with calling all these high schools, we weren't able to reach every high school. So we're trying to expand our data set to make sure that we actually have a full 100% representation of all the high schools in the United States. So we've been working closely with those organizations to try to help get those logged and mapped, and we have an interactive map on our website that will be able to represent the high schools in each state and kind of show the extent of coverage for that. In addition, we're also working with the NFL in their initiative in trying to place athletic trainers in underserved high schools. So this started out looking at the cities where NFL teams were, and we helped identify some high schools in the surrounding cities that were underserved and have medical coverage. And the NFL is assisting with a grant program to place an athletic trainer in those schools over a three-year period. And after the three-year period, you know, it should be up to the high school to be able to fund that. For the first year, the NFL funds 100% of that, and then they, you know, ease back year after year. So we're working closely with them to, you know, help identify schools and help with that. Another big initiative that we're working on, along with the National Athletic Trainers Association and the American Medical Society Sports Medicine, which is the group that all the sports medicine physicians are under. We are trying to bring together, or we brought together successfully last year, is our first year, and we will be having a meeting this next week as well. We're bringing together a representative from every state's high school athletic association, as well as each state's sports medicine advisory committee. So we're bringing together these two people from every single state, so about 100 people total. And the main goal is to discuss policy changes at the high school level and to try to help states come up to speed in having policies, safety policies that meet evidence-based best practice recommendations to help keep athletes safe. So last year was our first year doing that. It was at the NFL headquarters in New York City. It was extremely successful. We had amazing feedback. We had, you know, representatives from every state there. Over the last year, we have had some states that have made pretty good changes in helping enhance their current policies at the high school level. This next week, we're having our second annual meeting I mean, this is going to be taking place at the NCAA headquarters in Indianapolis. We're hoping again for another very successful meeting. And the reason why we decided to do these big meetings with everyone in the same room at the same time is, unlike the collegiate setting in the NCAA, at the high school level, each state is responsible for their own policy. You know, whereas in the collegiate setting, you know, if the NCAA makes a mandate or a policy change, then every single school and every single state has to follow it. And the high school, you know, Louisiana can have one policy, and Mississippi, which is right next door, cannot have that policy. So we're trying to get all these states together in the same room to discuss these policy changes to help kind of speed up the process in having the states, you know, adopt policies that help keep athletes safe. So those are some big initiatives that we're currently working on right now that I think surround athlete safety.
Unfortunately, this broadcast, your meeting will have probably happened already, but what if someone listening wants to get involved for the future meetings you have? How do they do that?
So basically, the purpose of these meetings, and, you know, this is our second year meeting, and we have another third year meeting next year. So basically, it's, you know, getting the top level of the high school athletic association, so the executive directors or the associate executive directors, together to go from the kind of a top-down strategy. But if people listening want to help get involved, they can, you know, advocate for some policy changes from, you know, the grassroots level, so starting from the ground up and getting some support from, you know, whatever state that they're in, and getting some support from the local communities, local school districts, and bringing it up to the state level that way, too. That way, you know, the state associations are hearing these recommendations from both ends. So, you know, people, you know, becoming more knowledgeable on, you know, what's appropriate for policies at the high school level to help keep their student-athletes safe, and kind of advocating for making sure that these policies that are in place are meeting, you know, what's appropriate evidence-based practices.
What are some resources to find out what the current policies are, for example, let's say in California, and maybe some neighboring states like Nevada?
Yeah, great question. So if you go to the Corey Stringer Institute website, we have a link that looks at prevention strategies, and we track five different policy changes. So we look at heat acclimatization, we look at AED, so defibrillators in high schools, we look at concussion policies, we look at wet bulb globe temperature policies, which is basically modifying practices in our competition based on the environmental conditions. We look at emergency action plans. So we track all five of the policies on our website, and just click on those links on our website, and what you can do is see a map of the United States as far as, you know, how many policies of the minimum recommendations each state meets, and, you know, they can kind of see where the current state meets and, you know, see the neighboring states. So, for example, you know, if you look at Connecticut, for example, heat acclimatization policies, there are a total of seven recommendations that would be identified as current evidence-based practices. Connecticut meets all seven of those, whereas in New York and Massachusetts, we do not meet all seven. Now, they meet some of the seven, but they don't meet all the seven. So on our website, you can see on our map that we have, you can see to the extent of how much of those policies are being covered in each state. And then each recommendation or each policy is also listed underneath the state, so people can get an idea of what's involved in the policies and whatnot.
KSI.UConn.edu is what I have?
Yep, that's it.
Again, that website for Corey Stringer Institute is ksi.ucon, like University of Connecticut, .edu. ksi.ucon.edu, and you can also follow them on social media.
We have a Twitter handle. You know, we have a blog that you can access through our website. So, you know, if people want to hear more about us and what we do and kind of keep on top of current initiatives and, you know, other stories related to, you know, preventing death and sport and physical activity, follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Just become more aware. And if there's any other questions, you know, reach out to us. We're more than happy to answer any questions and help in any way we can.
William, so far we've only talked about high school athletics, but I understand the Corey Stringer Institute is also doing research and helping members of the military and laborers.
Yeah, so we've been working, or we have worked closely with the various branches of the military to help enhance, you know, policies in that level. And our CEO, Doug Costa, has done a lot of work and put a lot of effort in working with the military. Our most recent group that we've helped is the Air Force. So last year, a few of our staff at KSI went down to Lackland Air Force Base, and Lackland Air Force Base is in Texas, and that's where all the Air Force basic training takes place. And obviously, you know, being in Texas, it can be rather hot. You know, they have had some issues with heat illness and heat stroke. So we went down there to get a tour of their base and to give some recommendations, and recommendations in which they adopted and implemented. So probably one of the biggest is they have stationary cooling stations throughout base. So Lackland is a very large base. Going from the most remote area of the base to where the hospital is could be a lengthy drive. And if there's a heat stroke, the ideal thing is to cool them down as quickly as possible. So what they did was they built permanent cooling stations with water access, with ice machines, with a cooling tub in various locations. So no matter where you are on base, you're within 7 to 10 minutes of a cooling station, which is ideal for heat stroke treatment, because as long as you identify strokes and get them cooling down within 30 minutes, you know, you're going to ensure survival. So if they're about 7 to 10 minutes away from a cooling station, they're still, you know, 20 plus minutes to cool their body down. So that's probably one of the biggest things. Another thing that they at Lackland, they did was the first time in the military, they actually hired full-time athletic trainers specifically for Lackland. And it might actually, step back, it might be the first time in the Air Force they hired full-time athletic trainers at the base to help treat and care for these athletes or the soldiers, as well as to train the medics and everything that would be out in the field with the rest of the soldiers during training. So, you know, Lackland's been making some great strides, and we're actually going back down to Lackland here in about, I think, 2 weeks. A couple of our staff are going back down to kind of see how things progress and to help, you know, with any other logistical needs they might have in helping making sure that these policies are getting implemented appropriately.
That's exciting about the cooling stations being put in. What's the Corey Stringer Institute doing for laborers and construction folk who are out in the heat as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of our divisions is looking at occupational safety. So we've been able to assist some of the larger construction companies. We've done a little bit of work with OSHA, trying to kind of help streamline policies and make sure that policies that are in place are meeting evidence-based practices. So I don't have anything super specific, but, you know, we work with them continually to help them along with making sure that, you know, laborers are kept safe, because obviously in the United States, our labor force is the largest force in the country. So, you know, making sure that these people are kept safe during sport or their working time is essential.
Before we have to wrap up, our audience loves wearable technology. What are some of the coolest wearables that you're using to achieve your goals at the Corey Stringer Institute?
Yeah, so some of the current wearables, we've been doing a lot of research looking at kind of athlete monitoring. So if you look at wearable technology, there's a ton. So we've been using some GPS devices.
William said these devices were used to identify stresses on an athlete's body and to assess some of the safety modifications that can be made during training.
We're also doing some testing currently in our lab looking at some wearable devices to assess hydration status. There is no device that can assess hydration status accurately and reliably during physical activity, primarily because as you're exercising, the water inside your body is shifting between compartments to help, you know, maintain your cardiovascular function and make sure that your body's able to go through exercise with the load that you're placing on the body, and as well as, you know, dissipating heat through sweat, if it's, especially if it's warm out. So there's a lot of demand on the body during exercise. So if we're able to find a way to accurately assess hydration status, this could help, you know, athletes, soldiers, and laborers develop better hydration plans for themselves, since, you know, hydration strategies are very individualized because each person has different fluid needs. So, you know, being able to identify a device to do this would be great. So, yeah, I think having a wearable device would be essential in these settings, because currently, if you look at hydration assessment, the only real ways to assess hydration status is looking at either urine, blood, or looking at body weight changes before and after exercise. And in some situations, these, you know, it's not feasible. If you're looking in the military, looking at soldiers out on a mission, you can't just stop there and, you know, take a blood sample or a urine sample or body mass because of, you know, the fact that you may be on a mission. In the sports setting, depending on the situation, you might not be able to do that either. So being able to have something that's non-invasive would be great to help track this over time.
And as we conclude here, and thank you for your time, what would you really most love people to get from your work with the Corey Stringer Institute, from your work as a healthcare professional about innovation, creativity, and making a difference?
I think one of the biggest things is, you know, from the safety standpoint with athletes and kind of my role with KSI and working with the high school athletics associations is becoming more aware and more knowledgeable on the fact that some of these catastrophic injuries and some of these unfortunate deaths in high school athletes can be prevented if appropriate policies are in place. So, you know, working together from, you know, the high school athletics associations down to the mom and dad in a certain town to help advocate for appropriate policies at the high school level to help keep their athletes safe. I think that's probably the biggest thing that could help, you know, prevent some of these unfortunate incidents from happening in the future.
William, thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thank you.
You and I have been listening to William Adams, Director of Sports Safety Policies at the Corey Stringer Institute, which is located at the University of Connecticut. If you'd like to know more about your state's policies to protect high school athletes, you'll find them on KSI's webpage. It's ksi.ucon, like University of Connecticut.edu, ksi.ucon.edu, and at the top of their webpage, you'll find a tab listing high school policies. You'll also find a lot more information and resources for preventing sudden death from heat stroke among all active individuals. Once again, that's ksi.ucon.edu. The preceding podcast was for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. If you have a question about any medical condition, please contact a physician. If you think you may have a medical emergency, please call your doctor or 911. And that concludes this edition of Over Coffee. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more Over Coffee podcasts, our link is twomaverix.com. That's twomaverix.com. And you can contact us at twomaverix@gmail.com. Over Coffee is a proud lynda.com affiliate. If you'd like to learn more about their excellent online video training, please check out our website, twomaverix.com. On our resources page, you'll see our Over Coffee podcast link. Thank you for considering supporting us. I'm Dot Cannon. Here's wishing you a cappuccino day.